Stockholm, Paris, Berlin, Kiev, Ljubljana, Bratislava, Amsterdam, Warsaw, Bucharest. A very warm welcome to Network Europe. Coming up on the program this week, could a European fire brigade boost Brussels' image?
The European Commission focused on trying to connect more with the voters, trying to offer them services where it's apparent that the EU is helping the European citizen. And what better than some form of service that would help relieve the pressure on really badly afflicted areas with forest fires?
Also on the programme, pills in the post. More and more drugs are being smuggled by mail into Sweden. Why the French have to take their vacation in August? We'll follow the tracks of John Paul II on the Polish papal train and have a closer look at smirting, taking off in smoke-free England. All this plus our latest quiz coming up on Network Europe, a partnership of Europe's leading broadcasters, this week coming to you from Bonn, Germany. I'm Barbara Groban.
Authorities in Italy believe the brush and forest fires were probably started deliberately.
Raging forest fires are increasingly becoming a feature of the European summer and sparking debate in Brussels over whether Europe needs a common firefighting service. Given that the water bombers, or so-called Canadair planes, cost more than 19 million euros each, many argue that such expensive assets should be shared. Better still, they could be painted blue and gold so that EU citizens immediately see where their money goes. Our Network Europe correspondent Stephen Castle joins us to discuss this idea.
I think it's a sign of the times, really. I think if we look back over the recent years, I think one thing that's marked most summers, and that is a series of rather extreme weather events. And on the one hand, you've had a lot of rainfall in Northern Europe and in Central Europe this year in Britain. But on the other hand, you've had an increasing incidence of forest fires. And I think that has concentrated minds in Brussels, where people and politicians in general are already thinking about climate change. These events are thought by most to be linked to climate change. And I think it's concentrating minds. And there is a growing momentum behind some form of European initiative which would help combat forest fires, which have devastated some areas of southern Europe over the last few years.
Now, in 2006, a report by the European Commission argued for the creation of a new civil protection force dubbed Europe Aid. How would they work and what would be their mission?
Well, the details haven't really been spelled out as yet, but I think the genesis of this idea is rather interesting and important, because the person who drew up that report, Michel Barnier, is a former French foreign minister, and he's also a former European commissioner. But he's since been brought back into the new French government. He's an ally of Nicolas Sarkozy, and Sarkozy appears to be backing this idea of having a fleet of aircraft specifically designed to fight forest fires. And there are specific aircraft that do this. And the main issue here is that these aircraft are, and they tend to be rather expensive, around about 19 million euros. And therefore, the idea here is, why not share this resource a little bit more than it is already being done?
Who would be financing such a project? Would it be EU funds or national governments?
Well, again, this is unclear. It wasn't really specified in the Barnier report. The funding and the cost issue is pretty crucial, because if, for example, these are all funded from the EU purse, then it could potentially create some rather difficult decisions. Suppose, for example, you have serious forest fires in neighbouring areas. How actually do you decide where to send these planes? All those issues as yet haven't been resolved.
Now, Mr. Barnier's report did not conceal the political dimension of such a new civil protection force, as it would no doubt make EU assistance more visible. Do you think a European fire brigade could boost the image of Brussels?
Well, I don't think on its own it's going to do that, but I think if you put it in the general context of what the European Union and the European Commission indeed is trying to do, it's a part of the jigsaw. The European Commission, after these referendum no results in France and the Netherlands in 2005, really has been thinking about its relationship with the voters. It knows it's not particularly popular, and it's across the agenda attempting starting to introduce a series of initiatives. One notable one is the issue of mobile phones and roaming charges, and these are the costs that users are levied, that are levied on users if they use their mobile phone outside their member state. The European Commission has stepped in to cut that. Now, you know, that's just one initiative. This is another. But I think what policymakers are hoping is that if you look across the board in a couple of years, you will see much more clearly and in a much more concrete manner how the EU is contributing to the well-being of the citizen.
Network Europe correspondent Stephen Castle on the potential of a European fire brigade. You're listening to Network Europe, a co-production of Europe's leading international broadcasters. Now, look in your letterbox. Newspaper, bills, advertisements, a letter from your mother and a delivery of cannabis? Surprised? Maybe, but much to the dismay of customs official in Sweden, getting drugs delivered directly into your letterbox has been a 21st century problem. Using the internet and postal service is becoming an increasingly popular way of smuggling drugs into Sweden, Radio Sweden's Gabby Katz investigates.
In the first 6 months of 2007, 920 letters and packages were seized by Swedish customs. And as the months pass, that figure is only expected to rise. Customs advisor Jonas Carlson explains how their job has changed alongside the internet boom.
It's changed in the matter that we are doing more checkups and controls at the arriving mails and parcels at Arlanda Airport.
Which illegal drugs are offenders hoping the postman will unwittingly deliver to Swedish homes?
All kind of drugs, but the most common one is cannabis, hashish. Also party drugs, as we call them, like LSD and ecstasy, amphetamine and cocaine. The problem that we see is that this boom with the internet, as you have a lot of sites on the internet that are selling and making advertisements about drugs, and the problem we think is that most of the people that are receivers of those letters are young people, like in the teens.
Does this mean that the number of drug users will increase? Kids that normally wouldn't have gotten their hands on drugs now can do so easily?
Yes, that's the problem that we see in the customs, that it's so easy to get the drugs home in the mailbox. You don't have to smuggle it yourself. You don't consider yourself to be the drug addict that you are common to see at the park benches and things like that. And you don't feel that you have to hesitate to be apprehended by a customs officer passing the border. So that's why the young people are believing that this is an okay thing to do.
And looking at some of the packages that you receive and tracing them, where do they originate from?
They can originate from almost everywhere, but it depends on what kind of drug it is. Like the party drugs, as we call them, or designer drugs, as they also are called, are majorly coming from Holland. The cocaine is very often sent from South America. Amphetamine is from Balticum, the Baltic states, and Poland. There are big producers of that. And cannabis is very, very usual from Spain because of the close borders towards Morocco.
Say you get one of these packages, it doesn't make it through customs. What happens to the receiver? Their address will have been on the package.
We take contact with the receiver and we have an interrogation with them to see if they have been ordering these drugs. But normally they say, I don't have any clue about this package. Somebody's wanting to make a joke out of it or something like that. So it's very hard for us to make it stuck, so to say, into a court matter.
Is there any way to fight this?
We are trying as good as we can, and we are also having good cooperation with the Swedish police about this, and we are trying to trace and track down those sites that are selling drugs, but it's very, very hard to find them. They are using servers in Singapore, for example, so they are very hard to track down. Every day, the whole week long, we are having drug-detecting dogs in the area where the mail is coming, and they are making seizures every day.
So is man's best friend also the best friend of the Swedish customs authorities?
Concerning drugs, yes, because we have X-ray systems, but 98% it's the dog who detects it.
The next stop, Arlanda North, is our final station and situated beneath Terminal 5.
Welcome to the Postal Department at Arlanda Airport. My name is Frida Martinsson, and I work as a dog handler. I have a Springer Spaniel. He's 4 years old, and his name is Toby.
And right now, Toby is very intent on chewing up his leash. He's trying to pull you away. Come say hello, Toby. Yeah, we're going to put you to the test. I can imagine there are lots of people trying to trick this dog and get things into the country. What sort of things have you come across?
They try to put things in coffee and perfumes. The dog has a very sensitive nose. It's very hard to hide drugs.
Well, Toby, we have a little test for you. I understand you have a little something hidden away in your pocket that we're going to see if he can find it.
Yeah, I'm going to put it somewhere here in the area, and of course he won't see where I put it, and hopefully he will find it.
Okay, why don't you go, Frida? Toby and I will stay here. You've hidden some form of drug somewhere.
Yeah, just a piece of tug, a piece of
fabric.
Yeah, I have had it together with drugs. It's no real drugs, just the smell of drugs.
And that's enough for him to find.
Absolutely.
I just have to point out we're walking through a huge warehouse at the moment. It's full of packages and envelopes. It would be hard to find anything in here, but let's see if he can do it.
Okay, just for you to know, it's in that cart. But I will start him here because I don't want him to find it that easy. He has to work.
Okay, let's see. Toby, don't let us down.
I want him to focus when I start him, so I would tell him to sit. Toby, sit.
And you're just tapping one of the crates. Show him where to go, and he's off and sniffing, wagging his tail. Nope, nothing there. Oop. He's gone to the other crates now. But he keeps going back to that one crate. He's going all the way around it. Oh, and now he's pawing at it. So he had no trouble whatsoever.
No, that's very easy for him.
And what would you like to tell those people who are trying to send packages so that they get past Toby here?
What can I say? Good luck.
And on to England now, and more smoking in our weekly postcard. Not cannabis, but tobacco. It's now been a bit over a month since a smoking ban came into effect in England, and there's been a rather stoic reaction to the ban. As the country moves into its second smoke-free month, Deutsche Welle's Carol Allen looks at some of the anomalies and unexpected effects the ban has had on Londoners and London life.
As part of the new law, official government-issue no-smoking notices have been appearing in the windows of bars, restaurants, shops and offices all over London and indeed all over England. This virtually ubiquitous sign says, and I quote, "It is against the law to smoke in these premises." However, one of the delightful inconsistencies of our language is that the correct preposition to use here is on, as in on these premises. The use of in this context is incorrect English, but embarrassing really for the Department of Health, which issued them, that nobody bothered to check the grammar of this notice before plastering the entire country with it. Meanwhile, in the House of Commons, some MPs are accusing others of sneakily smoking in the division toilets. It's like being back at school, really. Your home is, for the moment at least, still a haven from the law. But if you work at home and have, say, a part-time secretary, even if he or she smokes, that workplace part of your home has to be non-smoking even when only you are there. Passive smoking no longer means being subject to smoke from a lit cigarette. The law now insists on protecting your occasional co-worker from the one you smoked last week as well. Not so, however, your nanny, cleaning lady, or builder and decorator. No smoking has effectively been voluntarily in place for ages in most offices, shops, buses, trains and indeed many restaurants, though even long-time smoke-free zones still have to display those ungrammatical notices. But now it's been extended to all bars and restaurants. Health campaigners are fretting it'll lead to parents smoking more at home in front of the children. Well, with respect, they should have thought of that before pressing for such a draconian change in the law, rather than allowing non-smoking market forces to take their course. The paparazzi, though, are rubbing their hands in glee as celebrities, like ordinary folk, are being forced out onto the pavement where they can be snapped and, of course, criticised for having a quiet cigarette. The fun side of the smoking ban, though, is the rise of smirting, the name for the flirting that goes on outside the bar or restaurant, where strangers become friends as they huddle under a rain-soaked awning swapping ciggies and phone numbers. It started in Ireland when their ban was introduced in 2004, and Londoners are now taking to it with a vengeance. Tabloids are even publishing tips on chat-up lines like, "Do you smoke here often?" and advising on smirting etiquette. Suppress your smoker's cough with a sip of your drink, gentlemen have a lighter ready and an umbrella for sharing, and both sexes keep a supply of mints handy in case you get lucky later. Non-smokers are actually getting so fed up with being left in the bar that some of them are taking the weed up again to join in the fun, another blow for the health fascists. Overall, smokers are a tolerant lot. You don't hear them complaining aggressively about other people's unpleasantly strong cologne or BO, for example. But already the smoke haters are complaining, not only about open-air second-hand smoke, but also the noise and obstruction from the chattering crowds who've been forced outside by the same government that introduced extended drinking hours. Oh, well, let's just make smoke while the rain falls. I'm off out for a ciggy and a smirt. That tall guy in the Armani suit looks a bit interesting. Carol Allen, Deutsche Welle Radio, London.
If you walk around Paris these days, you'll see tourists, but not many Parisians. French people are on vacation and the streets are deserted. But the emptying of the capital is not entirely voluntary. Many French people are obliged to take the bulk of their holidays in August because their workplaces are closed. RFI's Sarah Elders has more.
Paris in August is a ghost town. Yeah, kind of like that. Walk around any residential street and you'll see handwritten signs in the windows, closed for the holidays.
We're coming up to a crepe restaurant. Closed for holidays. July 31st to August 28th. There's a newsstand. They're going to be closed from the 12th to the 20th. Toy store. They just tell us they're opening again on August 21st. No idea how long they've been closed.
This seems to be a uniquely French phenomenon. One business after another is closed in August for a week or a month, and the first 2 weeks of August are particularly dead.
Here we get to a bakery. They're closed from July 17th to August 29th.
One bakery is open. The woman behind the counter explains that they sell twice as many baguettes in August because everywhere else is closed.
Les baguettes, ça double, ça triple, vu que certaines boulangeries sont fermées.
Why are they all closed? Turns out, it's practically written into the law. French workers get 5 weeks of vacation a year that employers are required to let them take between May and October. And since the French population is, well, fertile, they have kids who are out of school in July and August. Time for a break. Here's Jean-Christophe Gaffé, an economist at Nexus, an investment bank that also provides economic analysis to companies.
Il y a plus d'Haussiens que de Juilletistes en France.
There are more Haussiens than Juilletistes, he says. Haussien is roughly translatable as Augusters and Juilletiste as Juliers. The fact that these terms exist is telling. Gaffé says there are more people who leave in August than in July, often because companies close up shop in August and require employees to take the bulk of their time off during that time.
For some companies whose clients aren't around in August, people are encouraged to leave then rather than in September, when things pick up after the holidays.
So it's almost a vicious cycle. Consumers aren't around, so companies close and force employees to go on vacation. But those employees are the consumers who are leaving. If they didn't go on vacation all at once, couldn't companies stay open? In any case, the mass exodus has an effect on the economy.
Usually during the third quarter, we see a particularly striking contraction in the added value of manufacturing, with an average drop of about 10%. It's particularly noticeable in August when we observe as much as a 25% drop in production as compared to July.
Café says that many stores will close in August because there are national sales in July.
They take advantage of that period to reduce their stocks before leaving. Obviously, department stores that have a lot of foreign tourist customers, they don't close in either July or August. On the contrary, they have increased activity in those periods.
Back outside, I do find a couple of businesses that are open. A dry cleaner has a large yellow sign out front with a Sun logo and the words open in August. The owner explains that it's become a tradition for him to be open in August. He took over the business on August 1st, 2001. He says he has to stay open because otherwise he won't turn a profit.
Il y avait une seule façon de faire, tourner 12 mois sur 12. Minimum de 12 heures par jour.
He realized the only way to make money was to be open 12 months a year, a minimum 12 hours a day.
Il y a suffisamment de monde dans le quartier, ça marche.
There are enough clients in the neighborhood, and it works, he says. For Network Europe, this is Sarah Elzis in Paris.
For Pope John Paul II, public protection on papal tours was of course provided by what became known as the Popemobile. But His Holiness also had a special train. 2 years after the death of the popular Polish Pope, pilgrims are now following his tracks on this very special train, which takes them from Krakow to Wadowice, the Pope's birthplace, and back. Amy Drozdowska from the Polish Radio External Service hopped on the train for us.
There's a lot of Pope John Paul II memorabilia out there. 3D postcards, glow-in-the-dark candles, cartoonishly oversized pens. You get the idea. They're not exactly what you would call dignified ways of honoring him. Now there's something new to add to the long list of Pope items out there, and it's decidedly different. The papal train is a special service offered by the Polish National Railway.
Dzień dobry Państwu. Serdecznie Państwa wita załoga pokładowa pociągu papieskiego.
Moje nazwisko Łaczak Adam.
Adam is a conductor on the train.
Jeździmy tutaj na trasie Kraków-Wadowice dwa razy.
As Adam's explaining, the papal train rides the rails between Kraków, where Karol Wojtyła went to university and was archbishop on the way to being pope, and Wadowice, the small town in which he grew up. Ironically enough, for a train honoring a man that some consider to be the very paragon of conservatism, the gold-colored papal train is the sleekest, most modern train in Poland.
I was really shocked when I saw all these technical things all around, all the TV screens.
Passengers like Krzyżak ride in a train that doesn't just look special on the outside. Inside are surprisingly elegant interiors, sporting the Vatican colors of blue and yellow. Mounted from the ceiling throughout the train are screens showing videos celebrating the Polish Pope, like clips from his speeches and visits home, and programs featuring painfully cute kids singing some of his favorite songs.
Dzień dobry, proszę bileciki do kontroli.
Bogdan is another conductor on the train.
This train is profitable.
This mix of religious reverence and commercial success is a sign of just how capitalist Karol Wojtyła's Poland has become. Even this train, with its solemn message and classy presentation, is prone to the demand for papal memorabilia. On board, you can buy postcards with pictures of the train and books about the life of the Pope. But for some, that's not enough. Even the conductors, with their bright Vatican yellow neckties embroidered with the Polish National Rail logo, have caught the attention of the souvenir hungry.
One day there was a group from Chicago. One of them, it was men. Men want buy our yellow tie, so...
Riding the papal train is really unlike any train trip in Poland. It's more like joining in on a party, a really emotional one that can take you off guard. The train's guest book is testament to that. Passengers from all over the world have filled the pages with
wrażenia z podróży, podziękowania.
So their thanks and their impressions about their trip.
An emotional journey, very moving to visit Wadowice. It was a very special day. God be with the people of Poland in the future. Mary Claire, Dublin, Ireland.
The train's employees, like Bogdan, told me they feel something too.
It's different, special job working here. I feel chosen working here.
Having a Polish pope was such a big deal for the Poles, a kind of coup. He personified their struggle for identity, the fight to rid their country of communism, fights in a lot of ways he won for them. For many in the world, John Paul II was the pope who was stubbornly stuck to old Catholic doctrine. In his homeland, though, this pope is remembered as the one who told jokes in the Vatican, who loved to ski in the Tatra Mountains, who regularly invited folk musicians from the Polish highlands to play at papal celebrations, who loved his country. Statues, monuments, movies, and now a train dedicated to the Pope. It's the making of a national myth. The papal train runs daily to do its part to keep the story going. For Network Europe, I'm Amy Drozdowska.
And from a train, we hop on board a boat. Nearly 350,000 people lined the side of Amsterdam's Prinsengracht Canal last weekend to celebrate Gay Pride. A flotilla of boats sailed along in the sunshine, but it was one special boat that got most attention. It's the first time a boat dedicated to gay and lesbians under the age of consent has participated in Amsterdam's Gay Pride. The boat was the idea of 14-year-old Danny Hoeksma, who wants more recognition for young homosexuals. It attracted fierce criticism from around the world and raised questions about whether young people can really know their sexuality at an early age. Paul Ensters from Radio Netherlands went along to see Danny's boat set sail.
It's early Saturday morning and there's a carnival atmosphere in the air. Amsterdam's Gay Pride is known throughout the world for being controversial and pushing boundaries. Every year, thousands of out and proud gay and lesbian men and women descend on the Dutch city to celebrate their sexuality. It's always been a rather adult affair. Until, that is, 14-year-old Danny Hoeksma came along. He's created a storm by suggesting that there should be a boat for underage homosexuals and challenging the accepted notion that young people can't possibly know that they're gay. Danny himself came out at the age of 12.
There's a lot of excitement here this morning. The boats are lining up along the canal. Some are already moving off. The young boat, Danny's boat, is a little bit behind in getting ready. There are pink balloons floating from the side of it. And Danny's father is helping to put things together. He's joining in. Everyone is getting prepared for this big moment that they've waited so long for. Danny, this has taken a long time for it to happen, but finally today is the day. How do you feel about that?
I'm a little bit stressed, but it's good weather.
Why is it so important to you that this boat should be part of Gay Pride this year?
Because there are much gay young people under 16, and there are not places where they can meet.
Danny is joined by 40 young gay and lesbians aged 16 and under. They're united in their quest to be heard.
I was 12 and I thought, I like boys, I don't like girls. And there are many of those kids here in Holland and out of the rest of the world. They think the same.
Danny and his friends have been supported by the COC, the main campaign group in the Netherlands for the rights of gays and lesbians. COC chairman Frank van Dalen has been instrumental in securing the support of Amsterdam's mayor, who was initially reluctant to let the boat go ahead for fear that it could attract the attention of paedophiles.
I'm extremely proud and maybe even a little bit emotional that after so many years and so many discussions and political debates and media and etc., etc., the boat is sailing today. It is. That's happening.
What kind of message does it send out to not only people in the Netherlands, but to people worldwide?
To people worldwide, it's the message of there are teenagers who are self-confident in being gay or lesbian, and give them space. Please give them space. It's about their childhood. It's about developing their personal identity. It's about being happy and having a good future.
Along the Prinsengracht Canal, the party has already begun. Gay and straight take their places to get the best view. But what does everyone think about this year's young participants?
I think it's very good that they have their own boat to show that also young people can be gay.
I really think it's important that people show that they are gay, and especially young kids. And if they come out, we also know that they're around. I'm a health nurse working with sexual diseases. I think sex is dangerous. And now, if they're in the open, we can address them that sex is dangerous.
It's nearly the end of a journey. As the boat comes in to dock, there are still a lot of happy, smiling faces. Although, after 5 hours on the water, some of them look like they could do with an early night's sleep. So was it worth it?
Yeah, it was really great. And at the end, I was a little bit emotional.
It was all worth it. Absolutely. Yes. A big yes.
And the same again next year?
Same again next year. We will have probably two boats or three boats, because I have so many teenagers seeing along the side. They were just thinking, I want to be on that boat as well. I want to be proud and out as well. So hopefully next year, even more pupils getting on the boat.
Paul Ernst is from Radio Netherlands reporting there. And that's almost all we have time for this week on Network Europe. But before we go, here's your chance to participate in this month's quiz. That's a classic scene from Fanny and Alexander, a film by Swedish director Ingmar Bergman, who died earlier this month. The legendary film director won 3 Academy Awards for Best Foreign Film, and we want you to tell us the names of these 3 films. You can email your answer to contact@networkeurope.org or write to us via snail mail to Deutsche Welle Radio, European Desk, Bonn, Germany. We have 5 special prizes to give away, and we'll announce the winners at the end of this month. Network Europe is a partnership of Radio Netherlands, Radio Sweden, Radio France International, Radio Romania, Radio Slovakia, Radio Slovenia, Radio Prague, Polish Radio External Services, Radio Bulgaria and Deutsche Welle. On behalf of the entire Network Europe team, I am Barbara Gruber saying thanks for tuning in.
Petite princesse, ma beauté, ma promesse, ma petite faiblesse, ma plus belle histoire de fesses, pour la Mercedes, c'est de l'espoir que je caresse. Soviet suprême, toi mon plus beau problème dans ton abdomen, tout nouveau spécimen, joue à la crème, c'est de l'espoir que je promène. Mon amour hélas, le temps passe, mon amour hélas, le temps passe, mon amour hélas, le temps passe. C'est pas l'heure de la promesse, mais charmante hôtesse, que tu fais de ta jeunesse, dans la mer Coben, c'est de l'espoir que je caresse. Petite connasse, pourquoi fais-tu ta radasse, ta petite putasse qui montre rien en surface, qui veut qu'on l'embrasse encore, l'embrasse encore. Mon amour est...